The CMO Confidential Podcast is a proud member of the I Hear Everything Podcast Network. Looking to launch or scale your podcast? I Hear Everything delivers podcast production, growth, and monetization solutions that transform your words into profit. Ready to give your brand a voice? Then visit IHearEverything.com.
Welcome to CMO Confidential, the podcast that takes you inside the drama, decisions, and choices that go with being the head of marketing. Hosted by five-time CMO Mike Linton.
Welcome, marketers, advertisers, and those who love them, to Chief Marketing Officer Confidential. CMO Confidential is a program that takes you inside the drama, the decisions, and the politics that go with being the head of marketing at any company. It is one of the most scrutinized jobs in the executive suite. I'm Mike Linton, the former chief marketing officer of Best Buy, eBay, Farmers Insurance, and Ancestry.com, here today with my guest, Dr. Dan McCarthy. Today's topic, the case for customer lifetime value. Why is this such a hard concept? Now, Dan is perfect to talk about this. He's an assistant marketing professor at the Gazzetta Business School at Emory University, where he's been there for a little over 7 years. He built a predictive analytics firm called Zodiac, which he sold to Nike in 2018. And he also founded Theta Equity Partners. Now, Dan's specialty, and you probably want to write this down, is the application of statistical methodology to contemporary marketing problems. And he has created what I think is the first customer lifetime value business school class. Welcome, Dan.
It's great to be with you. Really excited to talk all things CLV and how it connects with everything else.
We are too. Before we get into that, though, let's give us a quick overview of what you are seeing in marketing in the wild with everything going on, AI, big data, the pace of change. You know, recession, not a recession, coming off the pandemic. How's the profession trending in your mind?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, marketing has taken its knocks. So certainly budgets are tight. If you're a vendor, all those discretionary projects that would be very interesting to pursue. Yeah, I think a lot of companies are taking a much sharper eye to those projects. And this actually speaks to, what we'll talk about a little bit later, but you know, there's this issue of marketing accountability and how oftentimes the CMO role can be something of a revolving door, and that the marketers can often be blamed and be the first ones to, you know, experience layoffs when times get tough, because historically they've had a tough time being able to justify the value that they create. And so, it's all going to be, it's well-trodden territory for you, but certainly as we're having these, kind of uneven times. Some businesses are doing great, and so they're not experiencing any of it, but others are having a really tough time. And I think a lot of the first people to get cut, a bunch of them are within the marketing department. So so it's kind of a weird environment, very polarized.
We are definitely hearing that. We're hearing also from a lot of B2B people about budgets being cut and the rush for acquisition suddenly a 180 degree turn to, okay, now it's profitable growth and with a lot less money, and that is putting a huge amount of pressure on a lot of folks. And if, particularly if you don't have data or you don't have math. So with that as a little background though, and I agree with your assessment of the marketing universe right now, give us an overview of customer lifetime value and what you really teach in this course, because a lot of people talk about it. I'm not sure everybody really actually knows about it or the real application.
Yeah, we kind of run the gamut. So it's not a pure models course, but it's certainly not a pure course for the poets. We kind of touch on both the strategy, the philosophy, and some of the modeling.
Give us the cliff notes of that, the strategy, the philosophy, and the modeling, so people know the building blocks of the story.
Yeah, I think, this kind of mimics when we think about successfully implementing and making money off of CLV. That's really what companies are looking to do. They want to grow shareholder value. And if they can't do that, they're not going to pursue it. And step number one, oftentimes, is getting cultural alignment, you know, that you have kind of buy-in from people higher up in the organization, because you can have all the greatest ideas in the world, but you know, if you can't get your boss and your boss's boss to buy into them, it's going to be pretty tough sledding. You may not have the budget, you may not have the support you need to actually implement. So we'll talk about kind of customer centricity, you know, as you know, Pete Fader defines it at the very beginning of the course. And that's really to help just lay the groundwork. Like, why are we even doing all of this? You know, why do we care about retention modeling? Well, you know, there's a lot of value that can be made, generated by looking at the world through the customer lens, and specifically, you know, through the lens of customer valuation. And customers are really different in their in terms of the profit potential that they can generate for a firm, very different in terms of what they care about. And just leveraging that can create, you know, all these new opportunities that wouldn't have been there if you were just looking at the world through the lens of product. So yeah, so we'll spend a bit of time with that right at the front. And then
and just so everybody knows, and make sure I'm getting this right, Dan, this customer lifetime value says it's the value of all your future customer sales, and then how you can actually adjust that by improving loyalty or better customer feed. But it's really using the customer as the building block to your long-term financials. Is that a fair Cliff Notes journeyman summary of this?
Yeah, for what CLV is and how it could be leveraged, pretty much. And that actually is a great segue into kind of the second part of the course, which is how do we even define the damn thing? So yeah, you ask 10 people, what is customer lifetime value in terms of numbers? And you might get 10 different answers. And so, yeah, so step number two is to say, okay, let's create a formula. Imagine that we had these customers and we could see their entire lifetime. We could see the profit, we can see the revenue, we can see the acquisition cost. We had all that data. We should then be able to agree on what the customer's lifetime value was, you know? And right. So, but yeah, I think, you know, because there is that confusion, it really merits, I devote a whole class just to the definition of CLV, and then to, you know, kind of other related terms that are very similar and relevant and valuable in other ways, but, you know, maybe are not quite the same thing. And so, so I'll spend a lecture just on those definitions. You know, it's not about revenue, it's about profit. Specifically, it's about incremental profit or marginal profit. How do we think about customer acquisition costs? I'll spend a whole lecture just on the definition of customer acquisition cost. And I'll often say I could spend a whole course.
Which sounds like it's really easy, but it is never easy. And it's not, it's very complicated. So
yeah, you think it should be easier because in theory, it already happened, right? You spent the money to acquire the customers. They came in the door. You're looking backwards. It should just be an accounting exercise. Whereas, you know, CLV, we're making this projection into the future. You know, the future is uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen there. But I think in some ways, you know, predicting the net present value of profit into the future, in some ways it's easier because of all the attribution incrementality questions that inevitably crop up when you start really peeling back the layers of the onion on CAC. So I spent a lecture on that, and the time, you know, I wish I had at least a couple. But yeah, I think once the definitions are in place for all these key measures like CAC, contribution margin, CLV, how we think about some of the bookkeeping, then we start moving into the modeling. And I think there, you know, we're in a position, we know what we're shooting for. Now, how do we start making these predictions that we need? And that's where we'll start going into retention modeling. And then we go into how we think about spend, repeat purchase, and non-subscription settings, and then kind of rolling it all up into customer lifetime value estimates.
So that sounds like a super class. I've done this a couple times, or at least tried to do it. And one of the biggest arguments are the multipliers you put in for some lifetime value and the assumptions you start making about future changes to the product or the pricing or anything else, where one or two model variants can blow up the number one way or the other. Is that happen a lot? And how do you teach around like arguing about those variables and picking them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a statistician by training. My PhD is in statistics. It's not even in marketing. And I treat it as any other prediction problem that we want to, you know, to your point, we want to make sure that the model predicts well. And if you think about the CLV formula, right off the bat, you have to be a little worried. If you are using a formula, you're probably not getting good predictions. But you know, because CLV is a prediction, we can see how well we predict. And if we, you know, pretended like we didn't have the last year's worth of data, we could take all the data before that and see, all right, well, how well would my model have done in predicting
right,
this year?
Backwards. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a great litmus test, especially if you have some of the events that you're talking about, you know, pricing changes and things like that. It allows you to really stress test how good your model is, or, you know, maybe it gives good predictions, but there's some inevitable uncertainty or error. You know, what's my, you know, my 95% confidence interval. So yeah. Now we can start, you know, making sure that this is a model that we can trust instead of, you know, plugging some numbers into a formula.
And when you, once you have your model in this class, how often are you adjusting the model? Is it a constant organic kind of adjustment, or is it a point in time reference kind of thing, or is it a combination?
So we'll, in class, we will do some modeling across cohorts. And so, yeah, imagine that you're working, you know, you're the CMO of Best Buy or Ancestry.com. You have all these customers that are being acquired at different points in time.
Right.
And in theory, you want to have retention models or retention curves for every single one of those cohorts. So as those new customers come in, you kind of want to do something about them, you know? And so we call that cross cohort modeling. And so we'll have a lecture or two just on how we move from taking this one shot cohort to, all right, let's see what statements we can make about the entire customer base, you know, where we're kind of thinking about it in a cohort by cohort way. If we were doing this in practice, you probably would want to rerun the model periodically. But as new data comes in, you're going to probably want to take your old model, run the new data through it, and that probably should be happening on a more regular basis because new data is coming in every day.
And speed. Hey, so Dan, what prompted you to go down this path, create this course, do this, you know, customer lifetime value thing? I mean, what drove this whole, I'm going to do this thing?
Psychosis.
<I'm joking>. I had too much coffee.
Yeah, no, it's a good question because I had, when I first came to Emory, I taught a course on plain old marketing research, you know, survey design, non-response, conjoint factor analysis, you know, some of the usual kind of nuts and bolts of a traditional marketing research course. And it was going great. And the course evaluations were really good. You know, I won a couple of teaching awards for it. But, you know, my research, it's all about CLV, and my, you know, all of this, the work that I'm doing in industry, it's also all about CLV. So again, I like those concepts, the marketing research concepts, but I jump out of bed to talk about the CLV stuff. And so it's just fun. Yeah. So I thought, you know, first there is this real gap in the MBA curriculum where we don't have this. The closest thing that we'll often have is a CRM course.
Right.
You know, and this is very much not, and you can hear from this description of the class, it's just very much not that.
Well, CRM is, it just sits on top of stuff like this and optimizes it, or at least that would be my take, but it doesn't actually do it like this. So,
yeah.
So you create this class. And let's just move on. I want to talk about how come business schools are not like absorbing classes like this and big data and other stuff at speed, because that is what's happening in the marketplace, is all this stuff is crashing into the CMO space, and CMOs are looking around for how do I get a handle on this fast? And you can look back at not all the schools, but surely some of the schools and say, they're not evolving at the same speed as the marketplace at all. And your class is kind of an example of how come it takes you to do this class? How come there's not millions of classes like this being developed around all the new data and technology all over the place?
Yeah, there should be. I think that there should be a course like this that is being taught at many, many more universities than just Emory University, and soon to be University of Maryland when I move there. So I think it's been slow to change. And I do think that there is an element that business schools, course curriculum, it's been slow to, it tends to be slow to evolve. There's a lot of material that we teach that it's very over-indexed towards CPG. And it's not that CPG isn't very important. It's tremendously important, but other things have become important too. And so, if we want to cater to all of these other new, kind of growth vectors of our economy, like we need to have courses that teach concepts that are more relevant to those jobs.
We just did a show about believers and non-believers with McKinsey and the ANA. And what they said is one of the biggest problems here is business schools are not keeping up on the marketing front. Mm-hmm. And why? I mean, I agree with what you're saying, because having hired some folks out of B schools and looking at it, also my producer and I have been trying to talk to some of the colleges here just to help. And the reception on new stuff doesn't appear to be that great. Why?
Yeah, it's a slow moving machine. I'd say that now I know this firsthand. Creating a course, it takes a lot of time and effort and pain, and it's a real labor of love. And especially for a junior faculty, our incentive is, especially of us on the research track, the first priority is to publish top quality research.
Yeah,
that's kind of the first priority. So you want to be reasonably good in the classroom, but it's certainly lower on the priority list when it comes to what is it that's going to get me tenure. And so, people respond to incentives. And if you're a rookie professor, then you say, well, I've only got 24 hours in the day. Am I going to spend all that extra time on the teaching, or am I going to spend it on, on my research?
And right. So, and do you get credit when you create this new class? I would assume all kinds of other B schools are like, how can I get this class for me or my school? And we want to make classes like this. Is that happening or not?
Yeah, I've had a number of, first I've guest lecturing and multiple other guest lecturing from multiple other universities. And I have this like CLV case study on Blue Apron that it's been used all over the place. It's this case that was co-written with Eric Schwartz. Typically to make a wholesale pivot towards CLV, like my course is now going to be on CLV, that typically, that's a pretty heavy lift.
Yeah, it's super heavy.
But what I've seen a lot of people do is a lot of professors have asked me for CLV slides. And so they'll want, that one or two lectures that are, here's like this quick hit on CLV. Just give me the crash course and a couple of lectures. And so so it's kind of like a condensed version of subset.
But making some traction into there, and hopefully a lot more things will make traction. Hey, Dan, can we talk about, whether it's Blue Apron or anything else, an example of CLV in practice, like a case study, if you can share it, and also particularly where the case study showed a different outcome than the pure financials you were just looking at, the income of the balance sheet, whatever you want to say. So,
So Blue Apron and Wayfair are probably the two examples that I'm the most famous or infamous for.
I'm going to go with famous, Dan. Famous.
Yeah. I'd say the most recent fun one was Warby Parker. So I don't know if you'd have a preference for for one.
You tell me what you think is the most fun, interesting one, and we'll go with that.
I'll go with Warby Parker just because it's newer. And, you know, again,
wait, let me put on my glasses for the Warby Parker thing.
Okay. I've got my Warby Parker glasses at home. So first off, just wanted to say I love the company. Obviously, Wharton grown. They're an example of a direct-to-consumer, you know, digitally native vertical brand. And in some sense, they were kind of one of the progenitors of that category. And I'm a big fan, you know, but, you know, we had run the numbers on them before they went public. And they, to their credit, they put a lot of really good disclosures in their prospectus. So we ate it all up. But there's just a whole slew of interesting things that kind of came out of that, like lessons learned, and I think generalizable things that are more broadly applicable than just Warby Parker. For one, that was an example where we did find a pretty significant discrepancy between the valuation that we thought was fair and where they ended up trading. So, you know, we ran this model again. The unit economics were good. You know, we were inferring very healthy LTV to CAC. You know, better than the average company within the set of companies that we've run analyses on at Theta. So, you know, better than average, but that doesn't mean that any price is fair. So for that's one,
true. And CAC is customer acquisition cost for everybody.
Yes, sorry,
no worries. And
LTV is lifetime value, just for those who do. So for one, having good unit economics does not mean having a good valuation. You know, valuation is a function of price. And at some price, even a company with astoundingly good unit economics will be overvalued.
So, and you're talking stock price here now, right?
Stock price.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, even though this was a killer company and it looked like it was doing great, you could not get to the stock price valuation.
We were reaching.
No matter what you did to the model based on all the data you had, right?
Yeah, we reached as far as we could. Yeah, I mean, the bottom line on the customers, you buy that first pair of glasses, you know, the average amount that you spend on, it's about $180. And what they showed in their filings is that after that, you know, if you take 1,000 people that buy that first pair of glasses, about 1/4 of them will buy within the next year, 1/4 will buy the year after, 1/4 will buy the year after, and 1/4 will buy the year after. And so there's this question then of, well, you know, I'm sensing a trend here. You know, it's going to go out some more years than that. But the question is, well, how many years? And and we said, you know what, screw it. We're going to go out infinite years. We'll just say these people are going to, you know, 1/4 of the cohort is just going to keep on going until the world ends.
To be 1,000.
Yeah, until we're all gone, and let's see what valuation that suggests. And we still couldn't get to the market valuation. So you know, it's one of those circumstances where we like the company, we're rooting for them, good unit economics, we really played that up. But you know, we said, you know, we're not getting there by like a factor of two. You know, yeah. So it's not like, well, you know, 50 versus 40. It's like 50 versus 20.
wait. So now this model, you can't even apply it to something like Reddit, can you? Because, you know, Reddit just came out and it hasn't made any money for 19 years and its stock price goes boom on day one. How does this model apply to something like that? Or can it even?
Well, in theory, you could. Yes, actually, I was just talking about this yesterday in a guest lecture, ironically, as part of a class where they wanted the CLV stuff. You have one model for engagement, and then the question is how much monetization you get per unit of engagement. And that's, I think, that's the difficult factor. I'd say the other difficult factor is, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, upside to the valuation because of the data that's created being fed into LLMs, you know, who can be buyers of that data.
Yeah. And that's large language model, I think.
Yeah, so, sorry. I'm just going with all
that's
the
all right. I'm here to help.
Without explanations. And so what price do you put on that? You know, so you've got the advertisers, you've got large language model companies like OpenAI. I think traditionally, and this is kind of consistent with their disclosures, they'll often provide measures like monthly active users, daily active users to help you get a sense of, how much audience engagement there is. But there's just kind of that big question mark of how much money is the company going to get. And I think, sometimes there can be more uncertainty in the ability to, in that monetization model. So that's probably how I'd go about it. But I just think that I'd have a much wider prediction interval for the stock price. Because I wouldn't be quite as confident in that monetization.
So well put, Dan. Hey, so, given all this empirical data, because if you look at CLV, you look at some of the other data that are available around marketing, where you can pretty much say a well-run marketing company or with marketing in its center is in general going to be better than a company that doesn't have marketing in a like business. How come there are still so many non-believers about all this stuff out there where they still want to just put marketing as a cost line versus a growth item?
Yeah, I think it's in part language issues that I think marketing often tends to speak in one language. How they think about success and value creation. And I think oftentimes the finance department or the CFO, they're used to different language. They think in terms of net present value and project finance. And so, when they see engagement measures and things like that, I think being able to kind of go from that to this was the amount of value that was created or, just some sort of a proxy for that. I think that they need some help kind of getting there, And so, we'll often, I'm not sure that there's any like magic bullet to solve that communication issue, but I'd say that a step in the right direction can be this customer lifetime value type of concept, because at least for one, first, all the historical measures, they can directly tie to revenue and profit. And that's a good thing. The second thing is, you're talking investments again, except the investment here is the customer. And you have the marginal cost of the customer to bring them in, and then you have the marginal benefit that you get in net present value terms after acquisition. So, suddenly the CFO kind of hears all that. It's like, that's language I'm familiar with. Now, it's not language that I think some marketers are terribly comfortable with.
But they should get comfortable with it, because we have a number of shows on why marketers should not use marketing jargon or try and convince everybody that they should become really great at brand awareness and consideration and everything else. It's because none of the investors actually eat any of those measures. They eat the financial measures. Mm-hmm. And I do think marketers are partially responsible for being misunderstood, because they're talking a language that requires huge translation instead of translating on the front end. I want to talk about how do you get marketers better at this? I mean, we already talked about business school's responsibility here to maybe step up their game and evolve a lot on helping marketers think and approach things differently. But how about when marketers are setting their objectives or their plans or communicating to their companies, other than learning to speak finance, what advice would you give them?
Start disclosing relevant measures to it, and disclose them to stakeholders where they'll care about the numbers. And I think what that can inevitably create is accountability. That suddenly you're like, whoa, if those numbers are kind of moving in the wrong direction, now you need to explain what might be going on. And I'd argue that's a step in the right direction. It's just, creating that accountability mechanism for yourself, to other adjacent organizations within the company that allow that dialogue to start taking place. And it allows you to start speaking the language and thinking through, what is the relationship between the stuff that I'm doing in terms of brand awareness and how that's manifesting in these outcome measures that everyone cares more about, So, and I'd start with the backward looking measures first. So first, just the no predictive model, just give me all of the, the active customers acquired, retention measures, monetization measures, the sort of ingredients that, you kind of put them together and you project them, and that gets you to measures of lifetime value. But because they're purely historic in nature, there's no second guessing the marketer about the model that was used. You know, it's like these are just auditable facts. And
And the sales and profits that stick with them, depending on what you want to move around for CAC or anything else, those are auditable facts as well.
yeah,
So,
so I think starting with that's helpful because no one's gonna be like, ah, that's BS. You know, I'm sure this is just based on some crazy model. no, this is just the actual raw data. And I think once everyone starts getting comfortable with that, that also helps build the proficiency to be able to start thinking about the forward looking. So it really kind of motivates those measures. But it allows you to take a more gradual approach and kind of work the company into it as opposed to, trying to sprint from day one.
and can I flip this over to comp a little bit, compensation? Because a lot of marketing departments, they will pay for like actual marketing measures like brand awareness or CAC, acquisition cost, other stuff like that. And some of these things, they probably have some impact on, or pay for traffic. They probably have some impact on CLTV, but looked at individually, they may or may not work. Can you kind of just tell us a little bit about how you might compensate a marketing department given all the different functions that could sit in there?
Yeah, it's hard. I think executive compensation, having that being based in part on measures of customer value, there, I think you're on very solid ground. When you move to the market department, I think it still merits a place on the compensation sheet, that it's kind of one component of what triggers payment. Because again, that's typically, while I'll say this elevates the role of marketing, is because it's the marketers who traditionally are managing the customer relationships, and they're traditionally the owners of CLV. Well, if you're the owner of CLV, then you're accountable for CLV.
Yeah, and CLV is translating to sales and profit kind of immediately.
So it needs to be there. But I'm also the first to say, imagine that you're the performance marketer and you're only focused, you're in the customer acquisition department. Well, the repeat purchases a year later, you end up with these situations where you're like, well, that's not my, I wasn't involved with that,
Right.
and it's, yes or no. Oftentimes you want to be bringing in the right quality customers. And so that definitely is important. So again, it deserves a place, but they'll say, I passed my ball off to the retention person, and now it's their responsibility. So if they drop the ball, are you saying that I'm gonna not get paid? And so then they start getting upset. I'd say that there are certain measures that I think might be more aligned with the specific role of the people, in question. Like if you're a customer acquisition person, I think that the weightings of the different decomposed customer behaviors might be different from you if you're the retention marketer. But yeah, certainly CLV deserves a place on all of their compensation sheets. And it's just kind of how you kind of determine the weights for some of the other parts of it.
I agree with this, and I think one of the things to me is the company has to win the game. And if you had a great game, you can't just blame the defense or the offense for not doing their job. You have to collectively win the game, and the real game is in the financials.
That's why, yeah, I mean, you hire a sales manager and they get paid in part based on restricted stock units. And
Yeah.
that's, for public companies, that's a function of the stock price. And so,
Exactly.
you're very out of control of that. But no one, disagrees with that. We all win together, we all lose together. So I think the same idea should apply to CLV. And in fact, it should apply, at least that's even closer to what they do than arguably the RSUs might be. They
Yeah.
may argue that.
We're closing in on time, and if you have another case study you want to share, that'd be great. If not, I will go to the last question.
I'm trying to think the best. Well, maybe if you wanted to hear the aftermath of the Warby Parker story.
I would love to hear the aftermath of the
Yeah, and
Warby.
there was kind of interesting, there's this interesting other question that I think deserves a place in the conversation, which is that of information disclosure. So maybe a little on the one, a little on the other. So we came out saying, you know, fair value is something like $22 a share. They started trading at 53. You know, we're getting all these calls of, you're an idiot. You know,
Yeah.
you didn't value the growth options through the contact lenses and all that. But then promptly, just within a few months, you know, they just plummeted back down to earth and then fell to our price and fell below our price, actually. So we went back in and revisited the analysis, and we found that the fundamentals were relatively consistent with what we had inferred previously. So now we're relatively constructive on the valuation. So whereas before, you know, we were, you know, slightly bearish on the stock price, now I'd say, you know, we're slightly bullish, but it's within the fairway, you know. And I'd say that just the other aspect, this goes back to one of the issues that you inevitably start running into with CLV is conflict of interest problems. And the big conflict of interest problem when you're a public company is you don't want to make your, no one wants their baby to look bad, you know? And for companies, they want their CLV to look as good as possible, and they want their
Right.
CACs to be as low as possible. And so you have all these issues of, and I think this has held back the credibility of CLV, you know, to a large extent, is these companies, they start removing all of these costs, taking out the discount rate. They'll look to CAC and they define it in these very weird ways. And
In the smallest possible way.
Warby Parker, I would say there was some issues with sloppiness in their disclosures that we called out, and they actually had to restate their prospectus because of the issues that we pointed out. But they also were pretty aggressive on some of the definitions. And again, because there's no generally accepted accounting principles for how any of these measures should be defined, it's not like they're wrong in the sense that they could be sued. You know, I'd say that none of these measures have any industry standard definition. So I think we need to work towards that because I think it's going to help build the credibility of these measures for the next Warby Parker.
There you go. Here's a new class for you, Dan.
And
Yeah. So, last question. It's two-parter. You can take both parts, but you have to take at least one. Practical advice for our audience we haven't discussed yet, and or funniest story you can share on the air. Pick one or both.
Funniest story in what category?
Anything you want.
Anything I want. Well, I'd say going back to the Wayfair example, that was truly surreal. But yeah, we put out this analysis on Wayfair, bearish,
Yeah.
and in that case, yeah, imagine you're this pipsqueak third year PhD student. You're there just trying to get a marketing publication, you know, to make this pivot to marketing. We posted the paper, and the very next day, this famous short seller started to tweet about it, saying it was the best, smartest piece of work they'd ever seen on Wayfair. And the stock price fell 10% in a single day.
Yeah.
And I think it was like the biggest stock price decline in over a year and a half. And it just continued to tumble. And then it was featured on Jim Cramer's Mad Money. And you know, we started getting all these angry phone calls from sell side equity researchers. But yeah, I still remember this surreal. I mean, in retrospect, it was hilarious. Just having to go through that as a student, you know, just trying to get an A. You know,
But you did probably get an A on this paper.
that made the A. Yeah. So that was kind of the funny thing was we wrote this first version of it, and it used this data set from this company that wanted to remain private. And then we did this thought experiment, and the reviewers came back and they said, look, you're telling me this is like a method for corporate valuation for public companies. Give me public company data, you know? And so we hemmed and hawed, went back, found Wayfair. It was one of the first companies that we found that disclosed the right data, did up the analysis, and then that's what created Wayfair. But if the reviewers had said, you know, that first version was fine,
Yeah,
Wayfair
I
would,
wouldn't
we wouldn't
around.
have any Wayfair.
I'm sure Wayfair is not sending you free products. Anything else you want to share with our listeners before we sign off?
I would say, you know, as you can tell, I get fired up about all this stuff. I love it. To the extent that you're on your own CLV journey, please don't be a stranger. You're very happy to help share resources, slides, other materials, and help you along the way.
Well, Dan,
I'll take my course. Yeah, it'll be
follow the course, and we'll put up some links for you on CMO Confidential's page if you want. Thank you, Dan, very much, and thanks to everyone for listening to CMO Confidential. If you are enjoying our show, hit the like button, share, and subscribe, and look for all of our shows on Spotify, Apple, the I Hear Everything Network, and YouTube, which include Marketing, The Battle Between Believers and Non-Believers, The Budweiser Case, How Not to Manage a Socio-Political Issue, What Private Equity Really Thinks About Marketing, and Is the CMO Position the Hardest Job in Business? Hey, all you marketers, stay safe out there. This is Mike Linton signing off for CMO Confidential.